Enjoy.
And we're back. Welcome, guys. I told you I had a secret special guest for this week's episode, and I am sitting here with Yellow Springs native, none other than Trace Lizette from Transparent, and my favorite, Drunk History. I loved seeing you on that, and it also, it kind of endeared me to you in the way that I'm endeared to other comics, and that, like, insane jealousy, a lot of hate, a lot of watching the TV with a scowl on my face, like, how did you get this? But, you know, to be from Yellow Springs,
yeah,
and on a great comedy show, I guess I can be happy for you. So I want to start off with a little bit of a story. This goes back to when, it's not the first time we met, but the first time I remember remembering you. And you were the sibling of my longtime girlfriend from high school. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time, I think it was a Friday night, I was over at the house just hanging out with my girlfriend. And
whose house? Our house? Or?
Yeah, your house.
Okay.
The greenhouse on Xenia.
Right.
You know, so I was 17 or I was 18 at that point.
Okay.
And Leslie was a freshman.
Yeah. So I must have been, I don't know, sixth grade or
yeah,
something?
That sounds about right.
Oh,
that sounds about right.
Seventh grade?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right. You were in the same grade as Lauren, right? My sister?
A year below.
A year below? Okay.
A year below.
Okay, then probably, yeah, sixth grade. Anyway, young, and you began to, it was like after a basketball game, and you like laid into me about how shitty of a basketball player I was.
Me?
Yeah, and how bad our team was.
No, I did not.
And like how embarrassing it must be to be that bad at something. And I don't remember your exact words, but I remember like taking it, you know, for about 2 minutes or whatever. And I think Leslie was like, and I remember not reacting in a way that was probably typical of how I would react if somebody were to say those types of things to me now, maybe about comedy or something like that. But I remember being like, you're right. You know what I mean? Like,
wait, is this a real story?
This is a real story. This is
I
a real story.
This.
It's not over yet. It's not over yet.
I'm having a hard time believing this.
And it was one of those things where it was like, I can't refute any of the things that you're saying. I wasn't a good basketball player. I was statistically a decent basketball player on a team that had won one game out of 18. I was like the leading rebounder, second highest scorer. But when you're not winning anything, those stats don't really mean as much. And then it was like, I think it was the next day. It was like, or maybe it was Sunday. I think this happened on a Friday. And then it was the Sunday. You apologized to me in a very caring, thoughtful way. And at that point, I realized, like, I remember, like, I'm glad I didn't react. But what it brought me back to was, and I didn't have this thought at the time, I don't think. But when I was, like, recalling this, and I've remembered this story for a long time because it was a parallel story that I had when I was young, probably in about fifth grade. My mom was dating this guy. And I think I, like, he was drinking a beer or something like that, and I said he was an alcoholic or whatever, and he got really defensive, and it was like an hour or two later or something. I just said it in passing. It was like a throwaway line, and about like an hour later or whatever, my mom was like, Adrian, come out in the kitchen, you know, we want to talk to you or whatever. And so he like berated me for like 30 minutes, maybe 45 minutes about how he's not an alcoholic. I mean, totally like overshooting the mark to the point where I was like bawling and in tears. And and I remember thinking that what me calling him an alcoholic wasn't me trying to hurt him per se. It was more me like protecting my mom in a way, or like just being like, you know, you're getting in the way of me and my mom and my family and stuff like that.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what I was in your life at that point with Leslie. I mean, obviously I wasn't dating your mom. But I mean, I think it was just one of those things where I was just this interruption, and you kind of stood up to me for that. But I remember thinking, like, good. You know what I mean? Good for you for stating your position in this family and not... I mean, I don't feel like I was walking over you or anything or being rude. I was probably not a very self-aware 18-year-old, but I just remember being more proud of you for telling me how you felt than upset. Now, if you had said those things about soccer, I might have had a breakdown. I might have, like, seen red, but basketball was not my sport.
And I have no recollection of that.
You were young.
I'm having a hard time believing that. because I remember adoring you and Mike so much because I didn't have, like, a big brother.
Yeah.
And, of course, you guys would pop over and play NHL 94 with me on Sega. And
but man, I love that game so much.
You know, so I don't know what would have prompted that. Maybe I felt like you were...
encroaching in the neutral zone. I don't know. But I just remember thinking that it wasn't my place to, like, get upset. You know what I mean? It was almost one of those things where it was like, I've been here before. I've been where you...
Were we joking? Like, you know how...
I remember thinking...
there's that kind of sports banter. Like, well, you guys didn't even...
I think kind of. Uh-huh. But in a way, you were too young to, like, be that good at it.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Like, if we were, like, at that point, the same age... then it would have been like, shit, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. We would have been talking shit back and forth. But it was almost like you were too young for me to, like, point out any flaws.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like, well, you're six, you're killing it. You know what I mean? It was like after a really bad loss in a basketball game, and I probably wasn't in, you know, the most confident frame of mind or anything like that. But I just remember after it was all over, like, kind of like letting it roll off my back, like, shh. I'm glad you said it, because when I say it, people say I'm self-deprecating, you know? I don't know, but I just remember...
Maybe I was just looking for attention, because, you know, I used to wrestle with George.
Really?
And, you know, Mike, and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever wrestled with you, but...
I don't think
you know,
we ever...
I think that I probably just was searching for some sort of attention.
Who were your friends growing up through, like, from Yellow Springs back then? Who was, like, your best friend in high
school? I floated between groups. I was a floater.
Yeah, me too, kind of.
Yeah, like, I had different people who were close to me at different times. Like, I remember Naya Williams and Alicia Johnson and Lily Gehagan and... Elena Yoakum would be the one that I have really kept in touch with from YS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange how that works, because I did too. When I was a freshman, I was like, I guess my eighth grade year. I was in California for seventh grade, and then I came back for eighth grade, and I was really struggling with my identity, and I was, I'd like taken LSD and smoked pot for the first time when I was in California. So when I came back, I was a grown, you know what I mean?
Right.
And
we all did. I think we all did drugs at a young age here.
Well, I can't think of a safer environment.
True.
You know what I mean? It's
true.
Like the odds of you, like, wandering out onto, like, into the street. I mean, it's just the streets aren't that big.
Right.
It's not that crazy of a thing that goes on here.
Right.
But I do think that, yes, I did have too much access. But I remember, like, being a freshman, I didn't have that much access. I remember wanting way more access than I had.
Mm-hmm.
But in California, even then, it wasn't like I had a great amount of access. I just tried these things. And when I came back here, I was like, well, this place is too small. I mean, I didn't know how much I really loved it. I just was kind of bitter about having to leave California because I liked it out there. But all my friends that stayed got hooked on drugs and dropped out of school, so who knows what would have happened had I stayed.
Yeah.
But my freshman year, I remember just being really kind of in a transitional place of not knowing whether I was going to be hanging out with the druggies or the jocks. And once I started playing soccer, that pretty much consumed my life.
Uh-huh.
And at least during the season, and then out of season, I was kind of floating between the jocks and the druggies. And I don't know. I feel like that even in comedy now, I have friends that are, you know, Christian clean comics, and I have friends that are, you know, one foot in the grave.
Right.
And I think that's the Yellow Springs in me.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us had that kind of floating situation, like, well, this week on Friday, I'm going to hang out with these, and Saturday.
Right. I bounced around. I don't think I had, I knew I was different. So I think that contributed to it a little bit, just trying to find myself.
Yeah.
And of course I experimented a lot with my look. I was very eccentric and...
Me too.
Yeah.
I remember. Okay, I was going to say.
The blonde,
I don't know if you remember the loaf of bread head I had for a while. I thought I looked like Morrissey. But I think I might have just looked like a fool. But the dreadlocks were a nice touch, I think.
Yeah.
And then it turned out I couldn't deal with that attention.
Okay.
It was like people, oh, can I touch your hair? And I was like,
Oh, that's, yeah.
And I think that was me running, like my whole life, I've been running away from being a comedian or mm-hmm. from being in the public eye or anything like that. I thought I was a recluse.
When did that change?
Because
you were, I remember when we went to your comedy show the last time I was home. With Lauren.
Yeah.
You were glowing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's, I remember finding that in acting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, it was like kind of like hitting a rock bottom a couple different times in my life. Mm-hmm. And one time I was like just in a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, like, you know, I was watching Menace to Society, but I had been like on a 4-day coke bender. Ooh. And it was not good. You know what I mean? It was like my ex had left me with and the child had left. But it wasn't like they just ran out. It was like, hey, we're going to move back to Ohio. And I was like, yeah, and I'm going to move back there as soon as these contracts that I have are done. And I'll be down there. And this wind is picking up.
Mm-hmm.
And I got down. They left. And then like the next day, she's like, oh, by the way, I think we should break up. And I was like, oh. So now it's not. Now I've got no reason to come back to Ohio, and I'm in this big house by myself, and I was running a poker club, and I had access to like everything I needed, more money than I had had in my life, and you know, it was like good people that played poker at my club, but there was also gang members and drug dealers, and mm-hmm. so it was a very easy access type of situation, and I was watching Menace to Society, and there was a point when the grandfather asks Kane, he's like, Kane, do you even care if you live or die? And that was like, and I was like, yeah, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't care if I die. And then later that night, I watched The Comedians of Comedy, and Zach Galifianakis was doing stand-up where he was just like walking in through the crowd or whatever, talking to people. And I had never seen anybody do comedy quite like that before. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to live. I want to live to try that at least. And then the next day, my mom called and to see how I was doing just out of the blue, and I was like not in good shape, and she was like, okay dear, I'll talk to you soon. And I hung up the phone, and like 30 seconds later, seemed like, Lauren calls me, my sister, and mm-hmm. She's like, Adrian. And I'm like, yeah. She was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, nothing. And she was like, no, seriously, what the fuck are you doing? And I was like, nothing, what's up? And she was like, mom's coming to get you right now. So whatever you're doing, get your shit cleaned up and get ready. And wow. I was like, okay. And that was like the beginning of me pulling myself out of that hole. And that didn't happen just like, mm-hmm. you know, it was a long road to recovery. And it was, you know, that was just the rock bottom of it.
Right.
But I think once I kind of got my head clear and I was like working and I was going to school, actually no, I hadn't even started going to school yet. I was just working, and I was working at Donato's, and I had started back there as like a driver, which is something I did when I was 18. And it was just like this, like I'm starting my life over again. And then I was like, I got to take this more seriously. If I'm going to work here, I at least need to be like a general manager or something.
Yeah.
So I became a general manager in like 3 weeks. It was not hard. And, and I just started getting really frustrated with it,
mm-hmm.
and really frustrated with it. And I got to do an open mic, and it went pretty well. And then I got to do an open mic again, and it went horrible. And I was like, I guess I'm not a comic. And I started doing improv, and that's what really kind of opened up the door
mm-hmm.
For like, oh, I can do this. Oh, this is something I'm supposed to do. And everybody that I was doing improv with were already stand-up comics. And
right.
That helped. But it was after the first time I did an open mic at Wiley's, where you saw me, where I was like, this is all I'll ever do. this is all I want to do. I quit my job within a month. And then I went back to school and got my bachelor's degree while I was kind of like practicing comedy. I was like, if I go to school, I can hide out here while I'm practicing. Nobody's ever going to be like, well, why don't you have a job, you know? Mm-hmm. And I got my bachelor's degree. And then the week I was supposed to walk down, get my cap and gown and all that stuff, that week I was on the road doing comedy. And so for me, that was kind of like, I guess this is what I'm doing.
A sign, yeah.
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 Well, how did it start for you? How did you get, like, did you act in high school?
No.
Didn't do any of the plays?
No, I didn't.
Me either.
I started way late, obviously, because I didn't really know who I was physically. I mean, or gender-wise, I should say. Yeah, not physically. That's problematic. But
well, can I ask you, at what, do you remember, was there an aha moment when you were like, I feel different? Or was it just something that you weren't able to articulate until you became...
Well, I always knew there was something, and then, you know... First, I just thought I was gay because I didn't have anything else to identify with. I was attracted to boys from a young age. And then as a teenager, I started doing drag in the city, in Dayton, at 1470 West.
Yeah, yeah. I remember 1470s. That was the club. And I didn't. Yeah. I was like, why do they call it 1470s? And then I drove by it one day. I was like, oh, that's the fucking address.
Yeah.
How creative.
Yeah. So I used to do shows there, and God, it's all a blur. But I knew that I just felt a certain way when I was dressed, you know, female.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, I came out of my shell.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I knew I couldn't take that on in Ohio. I had gone to hair school after high school. I barely graduated high school.
Me too.
Had like a 2-point something.
Stop bragging.
Low GPA.
Stop bragging. 1.09, I think I graduated with.
Okay.
So.
Wow. Okay.
Chase was the only person below me in my class. Okay. So we don't like braggers around these parts.
I mean, the only reason I got through is because I got A's in art and like photo and PE.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And everything else was like D's and F's.
Yeah.
So I squeaked through and then... You know, didn't get a track scholarship because that was my first love.
That was another question I was going to have for you. Do you hold any records in Yellow Springs for track?
I think I hold the 400-meter hurdle record.
Oh, wow.
But nobody really runs that.
Yeah,
It's like a summer track event.
Uh-huh.
So.
That's what I would do. I'd be like, what's the rarest event?
Yeah.
They'd be like, pole vault catcher. I'm going to do that. I'm going to hold records.
Yeah, I mean, it is a sprint. But, like, you know, thank God Andrew Pierce never ran that event because he probably would have broke that record. But I did anchor the boys 4x1, ran the 4x4, hurdles, league MVP, all that. But in our little Division III bubble,
yeah.
You know, it's big time. But then I wasn't getting any scholarships to go anywhere.
Did anybody like? Were they scouting you? Was it something
Not
you
really.
Thought?
Not really. It was like having to digest that dream wasn't happening was really hard.
Yeah.
Because ever since I was a kid, that's what I wanted. I just thought, you know, I don't know. I loved to run. I loved Florence Griffith Joyner and Gail Devers. So, like, you know, I was glued to the TV when the Olympics would come on. And, you know, I had my nails long in high school and, you know, finger waves. I'm like, you know, I was very expressive.
Yeah.
I look. So, channeling them and then that dream didn't come true for me. So I had to kind of regroup and, you know, there was fighting in high school, which is why I transferred to Colonel White and then, you know.
I didn't
All
realize
of that.
That.
Yeah, which is a performing arts school.
Yeah.
Dayton Public.
Okay.
And then, so after high school, I just went to do hair in Columbus. Fell in love with makeup for a little bit and then was doing drag in the clubs out there. And
Now, were you getting paid to do those shows? Is it?
Yeah, not initially. It was just tips.
Yeah.
I mean, in Dayton when I was a teenager.
But even I've been to these shows. Mm-hmm. These tips can be in the hundreds, if not thousands of dollars.
Probably like low hundreds.
Yeah, okay.
But then I did start getting paid for them in Columbus.
Okay.
I worked at a club called Wall Street, and I think there was another one called Havana. So did that. Decided I wanted to go to New York in search of opportunity and finding myself.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of abandoned drag because for whatever reason, I kind of got on this road to transition and find my womanhood.
Oops, I'm dropping all my shit.
Oh.
All of my stuff. That's my vape pen and my, oh, just my Ray-Bans face down. That's okay.
Oh, there's the, another one.
Yep, I keep two. One's for relaxation.
Oh, okay.
So how old were you when you moved to New York?
I think I was 20
okay.
when I moved to New York.
That's young.
Yeah, me and Saeed.
Really?
Saeed Bowens.
Mm-hmm. Is he still there?
No, he lives in Texas.
Okay.
Yeah, with his husband. And we slept on air mattresses in a little tiny room in Jersey City because we didn't really make it to New York.
Oh, okay.
We made it to
Jersey City.
Across the river. And our rent, I remember, I think my portion of the rent might have been like $225. It was crazy. So got a job at Macy's, blah, blah, blah.
Makeup?
Yeah. Started transitioning. Bought my hormones on the street, you know, didn't really know the resources that there were no resources mm-hmm. available back then because trans was kind of not in the know. It was not in the mainstream yet. So it was just this underground like railroad of trans women that mm-hmm. showed me the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting concept, an underground mm-hmm. railroad.
Yeah, it was just kind of like we took care of each other and...
where there's a light in the window, you know, you can go. You know, it's like...
Yeah, like...
You can hide out here for a little while. And
yeah,
I've got
like you need your hormones. This is who you go to. This is the, you know, take the F train to 18th Avenue in Brooklyn and...
Did you find...
Go talk to this dude named Ralph and, you know, whatever, but...
Did you find bad information as well as good information in that Underground Railroad or was it all pretty nurturing?
I think I'm a pretty good judge of character, so...
Right, so you kind of steered.
Kind of, like, screened my sources and, like, took, you know, made my own decisions off of advice that had been given to me from different people, and there's always, like, safer ways of doing things.
Yeah.
And then there's riskier ways.
Yeah.
And, probably did a little bit of both, and found my way to womanhood, long story short. And acting came in after, I think I was around 26. I'm giving away my age now.
Mm.
Never talked about that publicly.
Uh-oh.
But it's whatever.
We'll edit that one out.
Yeah, so I had hit rock bottom, too. And I was dancing in strip clubs, cisgender strip clubs.
Yeah.
I also go-go danced like at trans, like kind of like fetish parties mm-hmm. type of thing. It was interesting environment. But then, you know, after I had bottom surgery, I was able to go and, you know, dance in the big cis strip clubs like Scores and Rivieras and Queens. And I danced all over the city for like 8 years.
Mm.
And I think it was like year two. I had a breakup with a boyfriend and I went to work and got drunk and some Russian guys had like propositioned me and I had kind of left sex work in the past because it was something that financed my transition
mm-hmm.
and, you know, got me to Thailand so I could have my surgery and, paid for my hormones when there was no trans health care and I didn't even have insurance to begin with, so you know it was something I didn't want to revisit, but I had just broke up with my boyfriend and I was like, fuck it, you know, a G is a G,
mm-hmm.
let's go party and whatever. And then I just went into the locker room and broke down and I cried and I just lost it and I was like, I can't do this, you know, like I didn't come this far
mm-hmm.
to give into this, and why did I just agree to this? So I was not in my right mind. I think I was just really all over the place, and I left the club, and I found like a little space behind a bodega and a piece of broken glass on the ground, and I just said, I don't want to do this anymore, and I slit my wrists, and I sat there in the cold, and two teenage girls found me and called 911, and I ended up at Bellevue for a little while. And I remember that was a turning point because, you know, my mother came. She flew to New York and told me how much, you know, she loved me. And I saw her face and it just broke my heart because I was like angry with myself, you know, but also my situation, angry at the world, angry at the cards I'd been dealt. Because I think I often think about, as a trans woman, I think about how far along I would be if I didn't have to go through all of that gender stuff, mm-hmm. and the hustling and the rejection from my mom in the beginning. We've come full circle, but there was some dark periods there. And where I would be if, you know, if I had been Beyonce with a two-parent household and, you know, like, put me in talent competitions when I was yay high and, mm-hmm. you know, and...
The what ifs.
Yeah, like, what if I was nurtured in that mm-hmm. way or, you know, didn't have to go through this fucking war with my own body and money and all of that. So when I got out, you know, I had a friend who was like always encouraging me to take acting class, and he was like, you know, you have so much potential. And I believe I had started acting class prior to that incident, but then I picked it back up when I got out because I knew I had to kind of invest in myself. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing was going to change. Mm-hmm. I couldn't swing around a pole the rest of my life. And I didn't want my worth to be in a man's love.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the start of me loving myself and literally taking that money from the strip club and putting it into something that would get me out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it started. And nothing happened right away. It just wasn't even till 2013, I think, that I booked my first Law & Order and then this other indie film that never came out. But yeah, it was quite a journey. Like, I remember my first acting teacher telling me not even to disclose that I was trans because I had told her, like, 8 months into class, I had a bedroom scene with a guy in class. And I sat her down after, you know, class one day, and she was like, okay, does Francisco know?
Yeah.
That was my scene partner. And I was like, no. She was like, okay, don't tell him.
Yeah.
You know, let's just roll with this, and you'll go out and audition for regular female cisgender parts. Cisgender wasn't even a word we used back then.
Right.
But I'm trying to be PC.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I was like, okay, cool. So that's what I did until, like, 2013, when Orange Is New Black hit, and Laverne, who was a friend of mine for like 10 years, I kind of got to see what that looked like.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't have to do this passing thing anymore. It's really fucked up that I'm, you know, giving into this. And like,
did that thought cross your mind before that? Did you like,
it was an ongoing struggle because my generation of trans women, like, we were taught that if you could, quote unquote, blend pass, then you should, because your life will be easier and you'll get access to more things.
That blows my mind because that's an exact parallel to how it was for Black people.
Yeah.
And my dad was, like, my favorite story of his is when he was a kid, his brothers and sisters would make fun of him mm-hmm. and say that if he wore a hat, he could get into the movies.
Right.
And so I was explaining that to my son, and he was like, why couldn't he go to the movies? I was like, because he was Black, and his hair was curly, and they would know he was Black. But if he wore a hat, he'd look white, and he could get into the movies. And I was thinking to myself,
oh, my God.
My dad's still alive. That was not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've made a lot of progress since then, but it's not perfect.
No.
So when I think about when you're telling this story, it is really kind of a post-civil rights. You know what I mean? Like, you're saying, like, to be able to pass would be the ultimate goal.
Right.
Whereas now, being yourself and being honest and open is the only goal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's, like, the only goal, especially for people like us who are creative types, I think.
Right.
Owning who you are is just as important as owning your work.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating story. So
yeah, the truth really, I mean, it did set me free eventually.
Did you have a point where you were in conflict with... like blending Or was it always like a kind
of... I always felt like there was this internal conversation with myself. Like, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Mm-hmm. You know, I knew things didn't add up. Like when I was dating and I would not talk about it, I would not disclose to, you know, guys that I was dating, and feeling like I wasn't my whole self around them, and I had to like censor parts of me that might be interesting, or might be all the colors that make me who I am. And so I was like watering myself down, which is not cool for me or for them. And you don't create real bonds that way. And so also I was literally going into character when I would go into work, like, because I wouldn't use any slang from the LGBT community when I was at work. It was just very average Amy. Here I am to make my dollars and get out of here. You know, it was, I was on a mission. And that didn't really feel good. I mean, I know we all code, depending on who we're around. We blend whatever environment we're in, if we're a kind of a chameleon in that way. But this was a different level of that. And also, I just felt like, you know, with all the violence that was happening within the trans community, that I wasn't being visible. And how could we expect change to happen if we're not standing up and screaming from the rooftops like, hey, we're here and we're human. I was living in Harlem in 2013, and there was a girl named Elon Nettles who was catcalled and beaten to death. And she died a block from my apartment. And I walked down Lenox Avenue every day and got catcalled. And sometimes with gay friends or other trans girlfriends. And you never know when a catcall is going to turn into a clock or a spook, you know, slang for what we call, like, when they kind of figure out that you're trans. And then their masculinity is kind of, like, in question. Because they're, like, they feel... Sorry, I'm, like...
Oh, you're fine.
I'm, like, running. They feel like their manhood is in question when that happens, because their first thought, they equate being trans with gay and homosexuality. So that was a turning point for me too. It was just like when Elon died, I went to her rally in Harlem at the park.
And that was like your kind of, your idea that you needed to be more visible.
I was like, you know, this is fucked up, and I can't, I that could have been me. And, having it happen so close to home, literally a block from my house, woke me up. I think that that coupled with the fact that Orange is the New Black had hit, was enough to kind of get me thinking in a way that was like, okay, how do I get to a place where I can be transparent, no pun intended, about my life and my journey and my, my gender history, and get involved with trans rights, because I was also seeking purpose. And so that's kind of how it started.
It's a very, it's very interesting to me to hear you like go through the like the awakening phase. Of, because it's layers of it, right? Like you wake up to who you are, and then you wake up to your possibility. You know, and that, that you are just kind of infinite possibilities is daunting to most people if they're not actively pursuing some sort of change or some sort of message, I think. And for me, like with comedy, it was my coming out in a way that I didn't think people would accept me if I said. And it was funny because when I first would tell people, like, yeah, I'm going to, I told my bosses, you know, when I quit my job, I'm going to go be a comedian. And they were like, good luck. And, and it was funny because, like, the week I did my first open mic, I think after my first open mic, I booked a commercial and for a hockey team. And it aired on every station for, like, six... it was, I think it was, like, 16 weeks or something ridiculous it was on. And so, like, the very first day I went back to school and I was like getting stopped on campus. Like, hey, I saw you in a commercial on ESPN this weekend. And I was like, yeah, no big deal. Saturday Night Live's going to call next week. And I had no idea how rare, how lucky that was. But it was I was at Wright State when I cut my dreads off because I was uncomfortable with the level of attention that I was getting from them.
Oh, yeah.
And that was at Wright State when I did that commercial and was totally comfortable with the level of attention that I was getting because it was, you know, it was like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I knew at 7 I wanted to be a comic. I just was afraid because I wasn't a strong reader. I couldn't, you know, I have really bad handwriting. I'm dyslexic. And there's just a lot of little things that kind of, I had come to an agreement that I wasn't going to be able to do it.
Right.
You know, it was like, oh, that's my dream job. But, you know, my other dream job is being an astronaut. And we all know I can't do that. And then when it kind of came down to like the breaking point of like quitting my job, deciding I needed to do what makes me happy or I'm never going to be happy. I hear that in a lot of people who are, who have come out of the closet or who have decided to change the way that they were living their life to reflect who they really are,
mm-hmm.
you know? And for you, I think it's, I mean, I think the last time we spoke was right after the, Orlando, Pulse nightclub shooting. I mean, I think it was that day.
Oh.
And, And I could tell you were affected by it like that evening. You looked like you had been crying a lot that day.
I did cry that day. I cried hard.
And I was hanging out with Phil this summer from Yellow Springs, and he lives 2 blocks from it. When I drove by and I saw like this huge memorial, like we were just like, it was down the street, but we drove by, I could see there's still this huge memorial around it and everything. And I always try to think in terms of, you know, what can we gain from this horrific thing? And I think it kind of forced the conversation on some people who didn't want to have the conversation about how do we feel
mm-hmm.
about these types of things. You know, is violence against a certain group of people okay? You know what I mean? Is this really terrorism? Or is this, you know, because to me, it sound that story, and I'm not like the most versed on it, but it sounded like Dave Chappelle's bit on it was, he's like, I'm gonna have to go deep cover on this one. It seemed more like somebody who was more conflicted than they were a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about these people who, if you don't have a healthy outlet to getting to who you really are, like we were both very flamboyant with our hair in mm-hmm. high school and stuff mm-hmm. like that. It's like searching to find the right frequency. And I think that that's like the quintessential human struggle is just kind of finding the frequency at which you can operate and not feel ashamed of yourself or other people pointing their fingers at you with, you know, going shame. You know, mm-hmm. it's hard to live. Life is hard. Do you find freedom now that you're like visible in the scene as a activist?
Because
that's also putting yourself as a target in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's probably the reason I get up in the morning is because I feel like the activism gives me a sense of purpose
mm-hmm.
that I didn't have before. So in this weird way, being trans has become life-saving because I have a cause and I have something I'm passionate about, a struggle that I know a group that's deeply marginalized and has been for a very long time. So in that way, it's healthy for me, but it's also scary at times mm-hmm. because I'm out there and you don't really know what could happen until it happens.
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like I feel safe day to day, but you never know.
Yeah.
Some crazy guy who hates trans people could see me and be like, yo, I'm going to take her out.
Yeah.
And I think about that. Like,
yeah.
I have trauma from transitioning in Brooklyn because that's where I was living when I was starting hormones and began dressing full time as a woman and taking the train every day. And I had a day job at Bloomingdale's and put a blade and mace in my purse and said a prayer before I left the house every day before I hit the subway, and had many, many arguments. Thankfully, never was hurt badly in any like altercations. Mm-hmm. Did a good job of kind of avoiding conflict as much as I could, but
Yellow Springs. I've never been in a fist fight in my life.
Really?
Oh, I I've been in some altercations, but I've never thrown punches or been hit in the face.
I cannot say the same. I fought up and down Yellow Springs. I mean, I was bullied ever since I was 5 years old, probably.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, like, ever since I showed signs of femininity,
yeah,
it was like the kids picked up on it. And,
yeah.
You know, I got followed home and...
Even here, I...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That's strange. I mean, and it's so easy for me to sit back and be like, I never saw any of that.
Yeah, my mom didn't say she didn't see any of it either, but...
I mean, it's so easy to not see it when you're not... when you're not on the receiving end.
And I didn't want to be a crybaby either.
Yeah.
So, you know, sooner or later, I had to stand up for myself. I don't think she took notice, honestly, until junior year when I got expelled for a huge fight in English class.
Oh, wow.
When we... really got into it, and that's when I ended up going to Colonel White. But you know, I was getting called the F word on the daily.
Whose class were you in when you got in a fight?
Catherine Birkeland, Miss Birkeland.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, but I fought literally every school year multiple times.
Do you think you had? Did you have anger issues, or do
I
you
carried
think you
anger
just...
into adulthood?
Yeah,
and I even. Had to kind of learn to curb that because at some point I learned, okay, nobody's going to stick up for me.
Yeah.
So I guess I have to stick up for myself. And I would go 0 to 100 real quick.
Yeah.
And I think I had to kind of reel that back once I got to a certain place in adulthood where, like, you know, yes, I'm a survivor, but that's not healthy. I can't mm-hmm. go through the world angry like this, but I can't access it for acting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's great. That's great.
So there's a big bank of stuff there that I can dip into from my journey, I guess, which I think makes me a better actor. I think a lot of trans people have that resource, which is why I hope that eventually we can go on from playing trans roles into just regular roles.
Yeah.
And dip into our bag of tricks, so to speak, and put it up and through the text and make magic.
I think it's one of those things, being from Yellow Springs, where I tend to no big deal things that are mm-hmm. a big deal to other people. You know what I mean? And so it's, but my big thing is to like not make anybody wrong for where they are currently.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I feel like when you persecute somebody for their beliefs, whether they're right or wrong, you tend to lose the ability to bring them around with some sort of rationale or reason. Now, some people never get there, but others will.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a struggle for me because it's I'm very opinionated and I'm articulate. All these things that I don't think that I am, I realize I am now. And it all kind of comes from this place of knowing what it felt like to be judged and knowing that that wasn't fair. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And mm-hmm. so I try to just remember that everybody's kind of on their own journey, and where I met them, where I'm meeting them, doesn't mean that they're at their destination. It just means, you know, they're still on their journey.
Right.
So I find it really interesting, your story, because I remember you sent me a message one time where you were talking about like your stage names or what name you wanted to be go by for your acting career and everything. And I remember thinking like, well, that's really interesting because I never personally thought about changing my name from Cosby. I did briefly because it's obviously the name of a much more famous comedian and and rapist, the most famous rapist of all time, I have to say. But it wasn't it was always an issue. I always knew how bad of a person he was because my mom always told us, if anybody ever asks if you're related, say no, because we don't know of any connection. Some of my relatives think that they have a connection or whatever. I've never looked it up personally. Mm. But my mom's biggest thing was, you know, he's been accused of sexual assault a number of times, and he's only not standing trial for it because he's so famous.
This was back in the day she told you this?
This was like when I was like, whenever the Constand case first came out, My mom was all over that.
I guess I wasn't woke to that.
Yeah.
Your mom must have really...
My mom was the type of lady that wrote letters to Sports Illustrated Swimsuit for not having any black women in it.
Wow.
And she was not even reading Sports Illustrated.
Right.
You know what I mean? But she was a letter writer.
Yeah.
And an activist in her own right.
That's
awesome. Yeah, it is. And it's... I'm very happy that I was, you know, because my mom was... I think my mom always thought I would be gay.
Really?
I don't know why, but it was always one of those things where it was, you know, it was always like a slight question, you know, or like, I don't think she was looking for it or like that's what it would have taken to make her really proud.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think it was one of those things that was on her radar and wasn't anything that was going to like change her opinion of me or anything. I think she always knew I was a little bit weird. And that my sense of humor was kind of what led me through my life. But I think she, even still, if I told her, like, I was, she would have been like, I knew it. Still love you. But it's not anything that I ever felt judged by, you know what I mean? And I always kind of felt growing up, you know, if I was gay, just, I guess I would just be gay, you know? I never felt... Like, you know, I have a very close family member who's bisexual who it never occurred to me to think of that as being anything different than how I always knew them.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that's the gift that my mom gave me and my sisters was that lack of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think of other people that were raised just down the street in Cedarville.
Uh-huh.
Who would freak out if their child dated a Latino.
Yeah.
You know, heads would explode. And I think
that's part of the magic of Yellow Springs as well. It's just this bubble where everyone is just coexists and we're all different.
I
had to relearn race when I got out into the real world because I grew up with so many kids that were biracial.
Yeah.
And, like, I remember having to, like, learn how the rest of the world lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, this is how fucked up it is out here. Because in Yellow Springs, it was just this bubble of, like, magic.
Yeah.
Everybody just kind of...
I think about it in terms of, like, I don't know if you've ever looked at the Yellow Springs discussion page on Facebook.
I don't think
Open discussion page. Don't. It is everything that's wrong with Facebook and everything that's wrong with Yellow Springs on display.
Oh.
But what I found is like the real, you know, there's some people that don't realize Facebook is fake. You know what I mean? So they respond to everything with their heart as if other people are going to read more than three sentences.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I try not to get into long Facebook debates.
Anybody that writes a paragraph as a response to a post is wasting their own time and anybody who reads it time because you're not changing anybody's mind with a Facebook post. And that's what a lot of the Yellow Springs open discussion pages is somebody will post an article or somebody will say something about Trump and then 200 people jump in with their own views of it. Like when we had the little riot down here after New Year's.
What happened? Somebody got thrown on the ground and tased? Or
essentially what happened was... I don't know if you've ever worked in a restaurant, but this is the best way I can describe it. Imagine this. You're working in a restaurant as a server or whatever, and there's like an assistant manager and a general manager.
Uh-huh.
And it's a Friday night, which is the busiest night in a restaurant. And then the general manager's like at 6 o'clock, right before things get busy. He's like, all right, I'm going home. And the assistant manager's going to go home too.
Right.
And so anybody with any real experience or anything like that is not in the house when things are about to get as crazy as they get all week.
Mm-hmm.
So the ball dropping here in Yellow Springs, that's about as crazy as a public gathering is going to get other than the street fair, which is during the daytime.
Right.
But it's not even like a level of craziness. It's just people walking around in the street at night. The police shut down the street so that it can happen.
A little tipsy, hugging each other.
Exactly.
Carrying on.
I remember the first time they did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it was like, this is awesome. I can't believe our town is doing this type of thing. Well, this year, I guess the chief wasn't around for this. And the most experienced police officers were off. And so they had like the least experienced officers coordinating the crowd control. And like 6 or 7 minutes after midnight, they drove their cruisers downtown with the lights on and sirens blaring, telling people to go home. And mm-hmm. they're, and that was just like, what the fuck is going on? No, right. Nobody did anything to have this break up that fast.
Exactly.
And so while the townies are pleading their case, I guess one of the cops tried to get out of their car and somebody kind of pushed the door shut or whatever. And so there was a little bit of what I would call tomfoolery, and somebody did get tased, but they pulled the spikes out and ran. And there was people like kind of like converging on the cops so that this person could get away. He was detained later, and I don't know who this was.
I think I read about that young man. It just seemed like an unnecessary incident to
absolutely,
me.
Absolutely, to
and
me
like,
too.
Abuse of force on the behalf of the police. And,
I would say, if the police are acting in a ridiculous manner, it's not unexpected that the civilians are going to act in a ridiculous manner as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more civilians than there are police, so it seems to me that the police should have acted in a more, could have acted in a more just non-aggressive manner.
Right.
But the thing that makes me feel the best about this, like I was saying, with the Pulse nightclub shooting and being as bad of a tragedy as that was, the conversations that it sparked, I think, were largely positive, and I think a lot of change has come across society because of the awareness. So I'm just looking at what is the positive outcome from this horrible thing. One of the positive outcomes of this horrible thing, or bad thing, it's not even horrible, was the sheriff's department came in
mm-hmm.
and relieved the Yellow Springs from the scene. And the guy that did that was Dennis Nipper Jr., who is a Yellow Springs alumni. So to me...
The guy who tased...
No. The sheriff that came in, because it was a Yellow Springs cop that tased a Yellow Springs resident.
Got it.
The sheriffs came in and relieved the Yellow Springs police.
Okay.
Said, go home, we've got the scene. And the sheriff, I think he's a deputy sheriff, I don't know exactly, but the guy that came in and relieved the Yellow Springs police was a Yellow Springs native.
Nipper's son.
And that, to me, gave me a sense of pride that it mm-hmm. wasn't somebody who didn't know how to handle things in Yellow Springs.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because
it's a different way here.
Yeah, I mean, people will say what they will about Dennis Nipper Sr., but Dennis Nipper Jr., who I went to school with, was a great kid and probably a fantastic sheriff. In fact, I think he was even being considered for chief of police here at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is what's important about Yellow Springs working the way Yellow Springs does. Is it it's just the same thing with like Ferguson, Missouri or whatever. It's like if all your police come from a different city, how are they going to be able to police the community the way it needs to be policed?
Right.
And I don't know what the great benefit of, or the great, the silver lining of this whole story really is. I just felt some sense of pride that Yellow Springs saved Yellow Springs from itself in the end. And yeah. Even in the end, it's like one of those things where de-escalation should be the name of the game
mm-hmm.
every time you're dealing with the police. And the police should be the ones that are initiating that. And I think that's something that we're often lose sight of. Because I know that the worst of some of these videos that you see, you know, end with somebody dying. But I'm always watching the videos, and I'm like, 10 steps before that, I'm being shocked that nobody's stepping in to de-escalate the situation.
Right. Yeah, my mind is blown every time I see one of those videos surface as well. I don't know what the answer is. Probably sensitivity training and...
Yeah.
De-escalation instead of these power-hungry cops.
Right. The one I hate the most is, well, if you backtalk a cop, you're going to get what you get. But that's like, the cops are to protect the people.
Right.
You know?
And we pay them.
Yeah.
So what the fuck are you doing? Tasing me, you know, shooting.
Yeah.
When it's not necessary to pull a gun or, you know, what are you doing?
And I don't want to act like every instance of police brutality is, or, you know, police shooting a civilian is unwarranted. Certainly, that's not the case. But just from the ones, like, there's some people that will never side against the police. And there's some people that will never side with the police. And I always try to be objective, as objective as I can. Like the kid that was killed in Walmart here in Beaver Creek. I was Walmart. I was in that Walmart that day. And just the conclusions people were reaching before any of the facts had come out, they had already made up their minds before any of the facts came out. And then they released the audio with the video at the same time that they were acquitting these people. And I'm watching it and I'm like, you totally snuck up on them and shot them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was one of those things where it's like hindsight being 20/20. Nobody should have died.
Nobody should have died.
And so how do you take a little bit of precaution in? And I guess the kid that made the 911 call was, files were charged against him for inciting a panic, but I don't know if anything ever came of it. But the 911 call, here's my conclusion on that, was like, nobody's trained to make a 911 call, but the police and the 911 operators are trained to interpret them.
Right.
So just because somebody calls and says somebody's waving a gun around doesn't necessarily mean that that's the facts of the case.
Right.
And watching the video, that was not the facts of the case.
Yeah.
So, but as I say that, somebody's listening to this right now like, God damn it, that was the facts of the case. I watched the video and sees it completely different than me. And I realize, you know, eyewitness testimony is the most unreliable testimony we have, so.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Somebody's got their two-cycle motorbike coming up the street. We might not be able to compete with that.
Is that a weed whacker?
I think that's a weed whacker or a leaf blower. Or somebody's just really trying to mess this up. But you know what? We've hit our time.
We have? Okay.
We've hit our time. So anything you want to plug? Season 4 comes out when?
Yeah, season 4 we just shot. It'll come out in the fall. And what else is happening? That's it.
You're on vacation right now, so you don't have to use all of your brain
power. I'm on a homecation.
You're living in LA now, right?
Yeah, I'm living in LA. I lived in New York for 14 years. So
you keep giving away all these years numbers.
Well, they can add it up.
As long as they do the math, I'm just not going to jump out there and yell it.
Yeah.
And then anything else? Anything? What do you want? What, like for me, I guess a special, you know, a comedy special on public television.
Yeah, when is that happening for you?
I'm so far.
Your comedy set was so hilarious.
I'm so far off the mark. Really what it is for me, at least with comedy, is I've really just stayed in the comedy lane. I'm not trying it too many other than the podcast. I'm not trying to do any acting. I was when I was in Chicago. I took some acting classes, but the place I was taking the classes was so loosey-goosey.
Yeah.
I felt like at moments I was glimpsing a passion, but at other times I was felt like I was monumentally wasting my time. And I think that that's what it's going to take for me is to really just, you know, I'm going to have to take another leap. Not just going up on stage and, you know, I've been more places because of comedy than I could have ever dreamed.
Yeah.
But it's like the term is crushing and obscurity. You know, it's like I'm killing it, but nobody knows it's happening. So I think
Well, you're also preparing for when that contact comes in for Netflix or
sure
whatever.
And I think that's my biggest fear in life is getting an opportunity before I'm ready to fulfill on the destiny that I want to fulfill on.
Right.
And also my son is, you know, freshman year next year.
Oh wow.
And high school. And I just, you know, I'm not like a great dad by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm more involved with my son's life than my dad ever was with mine. Mm-hmm. And I think my dad was more involved in my life than his parents than his dad was with his, and he came from his parents were together their whole lives.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, just kind of try to do better than your parents did for you. And I don't want to be in New York or LA while he's having his high school issues here.
Yeah.
And trying to relate. Now, if God forbid something happens and it takes me there before I think I'm ready and I go and I take the opportunity, I would do that. But I want to be intentionally basing myself out of here because I'm gone. You know, I work 20 to 34 weeks a year anyway, so that's more than half the year I'm on the road. And that feels like a huge strain. But for the last 6 years, I've coached a soccer team.
Yeah.
And I've been there for most of the important times.
Extremely important. I mean, my dad left when I was 7 and moved 4 hours away. And I think I was forever seeking out male role models, even now into adulthood, you know, I was searching for that kind of love from a man, and then it got twisted into, you know, a bunch of assholes I dealt with in my 20s, and and only, you know, now I love myself enough that to know that I don't really need anybody.
Right.
If somebody comes along, great. But, you know, I did find positive real male role models in my teen years, like through Mr. Gudgel.
Yeah.
So I was lucky in that way, but I think that's awesome.
Well, thanks. And I think it's also, I think I say, you know, what's good for me is good for him. So if it was the right opportunity, you know, I would go wherever that was.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just, I never thought I'd be here. You know what I mean? And so that's still a lot to deal with. And it's like this thing we, you know, comedians, we write, well, the comedians I like, we write our own material. And so it's like developing that takes a little bit of time.
Can I ask what's your take on Dave's new stand-up? Did you see some of the...
I saw both of his new specials. And I thought... How do I say this? I thought that the LA show was the moves, the mechanics of it was masterclass on how you structure some controversial. It was like a stack of almost like steroids, where like you have to sequence them in just right, or else it makes the whole thing not work. And then I thought his Austin special was, he looked like he was having a lot of fun. The topics that he covered, I felt like, I think he took as maybe even 101%, maybe 110% of the creative license that he could get away with just from being Dave Chappelle.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm probably the only one that can get away with saying this as a comedian. Everybody else would get skewered. And even some people, you know, some people did take issue with some of the topics he covered. But I felt like, just like with most things, the silver lining is if it gets us talking, progress can be made from there. And progress, the way I do it in my comedy special or my comedy set, is I reference that progress is painful.
Yeah.
And it should be.
Yeah, I guess for me, when I watched it, specifically the stuff about trans people, I just felt like, oh, Dave doesn't have any trans friends. That's what came to my mind. Was like, oh, you don't have a close trans friend, because if you did, you would never be saying these things.
I don't remember what he said specifically about trans.
There was a suggestion that we go and get our sex change to go to the club and trick men. There was a line in there about that. There was another one about referencing the violence against us. He said something about a brother putting pumps on
would be
safer than
he was okay, so
black manhood, or I might be quoting it wrong, but
I think he was saying kind of playing against each other, the violence against the African-American community versus violence against the trans community, and that the African-American community might consider transitioning to avoid some of the violence that they're experiencing.
Which is not a good...
Which is ridiculous.
...thing to say.
It's just a ridiculous thing
to say. The rate of trans murders is through the roof.
And it's also one of those things like per capita.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? We're a sliver of the population.
Right. A sliver of the population.
Right. And it just was not a good comparison. Also, because both of these groups are extremely marginalized.
Sure.
So we should be sticking together.
Sure.
Have
you ever watched Eddie Murphy Raw or any of Eddie Murphy's early stuff?
Is that the one with the red leather?
Yeah. There's red leather and purple leather.
I believe I have. Why is there some transphobic stuff?
Not transphobic, but definitely homophobic.
Okay.
And very, like Joe Rogan, who's not what I would consider the most balanced, but he's pretty open, you know, but he says the F word enough to like not get it, you know? And so, but even he was watching it and he was like, God damn, this is too much. This could never come out today. This is offensive. And so I went back and I watched Raw and Delirious, and I was like, he's, you know, like.
Well, he's. It's many things to say about Eddie Murphy. He's.
He does have a.
He has a deep past with the trans community. Yeah. I have several girlfriends who have had relations with him, business relations, and. You know, there is a lot of rumors, and I think he's one of those men that probably should have owned up to his affinity for trans women.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of celebrities, a lot of powerful men in the government, and, you know, I won't start naming names, but I feel like sooner or later, the people who deal with us behind closed doors are going to have to eventually start standing up for us and letting people know that our lives matter and releasing the shame and the stigma of having relations with trans women, mm-hmm. whether it's romantic or just, you know, casual or whatever, a friendship or whatever. I just think that is a problem that's existed for far too long, and mm-hmm. I'm fucking tired of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's not, I think it's akin to slave owners mm-hmm. having, you know, their mistresses and all the different ways that our construct has continued to marginalize people as a group, but individually have their side piece.
Yeah.
And I think that that's I don't want to say that that's human nature, but what is human nature is not wanting to be ostracized.
Yeah.
But then jumping on the bandwagon to ostracize somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
when Dave was telling those jokes, I just felt like, how could, you know, as an oppressed person, how could you do that to somebody else? Like, you know, we've been the joke for so long.
Yeah.
And we're waiting to be human. We're waiting to, and of course he's going to make those jokes because the media only shows images of us being murdered and sexualized and, you know, being crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We're often the one episode trope. Mm-hmm. If you get to see us at all,
mm-hmm.
you never get to see us being loved. You never get to see us have a family.
Mm-hmm.
You never get to see us really be human. So of course we're going to be the joke. Of course we're not human to you yet. And for me, when I saw that Netflix special, I just thought, you know, as brilliant as Dave is,
yeah.
I feel like maybe he needs to get to know trans people a little bit better on a personal level to kind of understand what we've been through.
Yeah, I think that, what do you say, ignorance is not an excuse, or it's... I mean, he knows so many people. He sees so many people. It's kind of hard for me to think that he doesn't on some level understand.
Yeah.
There's been some things, some points that he's made in that I think as a comedian, personally, we have a kind of a code of ethics that is one rule, basically, no ethics.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't go, that goes for comedian to comedian.
Right.
You know what I mean? That means like I get to say the most horrible thing that I can to another comedian if I think I can get a laugh.
Mm-hmm. Or about myself.
Or about myself.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, like I said, I think Dave was taking a license where, so I'll ask you this. Or have you written him off? Because of those jokes?
No, I have not. Because I first of all, I have way too many mutual friends. His one of his best friends, Donnell Rawlings, the mother of his child, Stephanie, is a good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
We worked together for years in New York. And I know Joan Chappelle and, you know, went to school with Titus and Bianca and whatnot. So there's that connection, the Yellow Springs connection. There's also the fact that I really loved Block Party, the movie.
Yeah,
I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
When he went to Central State and,
yeah.
you know, the whole journey to Bed-Stuy. You know, I lived in Brooklyn for 10 years, so I know Quincy, that street that he did the party on at the Fallen Angel.
Right.
And I'm a fan of his. I think he's brilliant.
But as a fan, you're allowed to say, I want you to do better.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's exempt from critique, and it's just my thoughts coming from a place of love.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not hating. When I witnessed it, I just thought, oh, Dave must not have a trans person in his inner circle, mm-hmm. because when you know better, you do better. And like, if you know that the jokes that have been told about trans people for decades is linked to the violence against us, I think to me that is the point in which you realize, oh, this could really impact somebody's life. You know, when you suggest that we are a performance or a costume or
the one that I can't
getting
stand.
Surgery to go to the club to trick, quote unquote, trick
the trick,
dudes
the
into
trick, the trick
being
is
with
the
us,
one that I don't.
That
like.
Is what will trickle down into a dude's brain and make him snap. The next time I'm at a club, dancing, doing a little two-step, and then I say, "Hey, baby, I got something to tell you before we go on a coffee date. I'm trans." Oh, say what?
Yeah.
And then he's in his bag, or he's knocking me out.
Yeah.
And oh, that's a motherfucking dude. Like I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've damn near had it happen to me. So, you know, I don't think that he understands that link.
Yeah.
And some people talked about it, but I think that he did kind of ride on the fact that he's Dave Chappelle. And
yeah, and I think arguably the most visible, not visible, but the most sought after comedian because he's so reclusive.
Right.
Yeah, I don't ever want to be telling a joke personally for shock value. And I have a couple jokes that get a laugh because of the shock value of the joke.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that even inside of the shock value, there's still a message.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what, it's really where the deficit for my comedy comes from, is that like some of the specials that Dave has had, I want to say something important sandwiched between some silliness.
Right.
And I don't really want to marginalize anybody, but I do feel like lately I have been becoming more aware of a need to shift the way I tell my jokes, because I think I've been marginalizing Latinos in some way, shape, or form. But it's really, the joke is on me.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that there's some pullback. And so I'm always like, so it's so hard to be a comic because you're...
I'm sure it's hard. I'm sure it's hard to avoid...
I mean, let's put it this way. There's people that get offended. I had a lady get offended because I was telling biracial jokes.
Yeah. Which I thought were hilarious, by the way.
I mean, to me, it's like...
But I'm from Yellow Springs.
Yeah.
And there's this, you know, large percentage of biracial people that's like, you know, where else does that happen?
I get a number of people that say that's not funny, that's not cool, we're past that, we're past all this, that, and the other. And it's always white people.
Mm.
I've never had a biracial or black person come up to me and tell me that everything's better now. I shouldn't be talking about those things. And it's not, I'm not making them wrong. I'm just, my thought is like, if you don't experience racism in your life, good for you.
Yeah.
But don't expect other people to be living the same experience that you're having if you're not experiencing anything bad in your life.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people experience hate on a daily basis just for being who they are.
Yeah.
It's never going to be a society where everybody feels equal, and I don't know that it's supposed to, but we should all feel safe, and we should all we should all respect each other enough to not hurt people. I think that the problem with comedy lately is that there is this as much as comics say the wrong things and say shocking things for shock value, there is a social media kind of phenomenon where people can be shamed past the point of common sense for things that mistakes that they may have transgressions that they may have made because of this like ability to take somebody's job from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think that's what I think a lot of people thought was happening with Bill Cosby. Like, well, he's so rich and famous, he's just a target. And then it's like this list just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And more like people that are like, okay, well, we got to believe this person.
Right.
And then you start to realize like, oh, okay, maybe it is not just a witch hunt. Maybe this person is really guilty and deserves this level of scrutiny. But But I've seen other people try to start just a hate wagon against somebody for doing something one time that may or may not have been misinterpreted, because of the ability to spread a message so quickly on social media.
Right.
And I think, like, you know, it's like, oh, we got to boycott this or we got to boycott that. And I think, you know, boycotts, there's kind of only one successful one in history. You know, I think we all kind of, like me, I don't shop at Walmart. But I don't call it a boycott. I'm just voting with my dollars.
Right.
You know, and I think that, and I'm not encouraging anybody else to not shop at Walmart. I just don't shop there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so
I think this, our generation and the generation below us is getting a lot smarter with where we spend.
Yeah.
And that's good because that's really what they listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. Money. At the end of the day. I mean, I don't vote. But I vote with my dollars. You know what I mean? Like, I vote in the local election. I don't vote for the president because by then, my choices are all gone. Mm. You know, I'm not going to say I never would. But, you know, once Bernie was out of the running, I was out of the running. Okay. And I think it's also one of those things where it's like, you know, the people choose what they want to get upset about. And I think some people just choose in general to be upset.
Yeah.
And I choose to be... reflective. I am sad and I am upset about this Manchester bombing.
Yeah. It's crazy.
But the beauty of the people coming together there and all these different faces and they're standing there unafraid. That's what I pay attention to, you know, because if I pay attention to the bomber, then he wins. That's what he wanted. And I don't give a fuck about him.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Trace, for being with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
In our hometown. And the rain held off the wind. Not so kind. But I'll be able to edit that out, I think. And you're off to LA. When do you leave?
I stay here till Saturday morning.
Oh.
Yeah.
And headlining the Funny Bone on Sunday.
Back to the grind. Oh, really?
Yeah, I just got the call right before we met. And I'm going to put that show together from top to bottom. So.
I wish I had stayed an extra week because it... flew by.
Yeah.
And I may have to come back again over the course of the summer.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Recharge the battery. So do you, the whole season 4 is in the can?
Season 4 is shot. It's done. Wrapped.
Have you heard about a season 5 yet?
I have not, but I'm pretty confident that we're renewed.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I missed the memo, but, yeah, probably.
That's exciting. It's just... It's, you know, I'm insanely jealous of you, but in a good way. You know what I mean? Like, some people are, like, jealousy eats them up inside.
Yeah.
And why not me?
Yeah.
But my jealousy is more of a thing of, an empathetic joy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm empathetic with your joy, and that shows up for me as a form of jealousy because I want joy, too. You know,
yeah.
I want to share that joy. I want to share in the joy. But it's like... My thing is, it's going to come from a different thing. I can't be you. I can't be experiencing your experiences. So it's...
And you'll get it. And it's all relative, too. I mean,
yeah.
I know it probably looks like one thing.
Yeah, yeah,
looking
yeah.
Looking at
yeah.
what's going on with me and my career. But being in it is different.
Yeah.
You know,
Absolutely.
I see things that everyone else is not seeing. Like, you know, why can't I get in for this movie?
Or, yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Why
can't it's a whole new level
know,
of disappointment.
Why am I still a guest star? Like,
yeah.
why can't I, you know... Blah, blah, blah. But
this time last year, I was working my ass off touring. And it had just, like, all come at one time. Like I got booked in 15 clubs in one sitting. And it was, like, what I had been waiting for, the next level that I had been waiting for. I was like, once I get to this level, then I can breathe. And it only took being at that level for a couple of weeks before I was like, okay, so what's the next level? What's the next level? I can do something.
It's like a drug.
Yeah, it is. And
it's like a drug.
It's...
I think until I get a house and like a piece of this earth that I own that I can call mine and have this financial stability to be able to help the people I love and still have this amazing opportunity to be a voice for my community and for not just my community, but all marginalized people, mm-hmm. And fight for the good. Mm-hmm. I think until then, I might still feel like...
unsatisfied?
Like a little bit, yeah. In a good way, probably.
Yeah. That's what I mean,
me
too.
Moving, you know, yeah. To keep me going, hungry.
That's what I've kind of come to grips with, is that I'll always feel this way. Mm-hmm. And that retirement is, for me, by force, not by choice. You know what I mean? Like, as long as I'm doing this kind of work, why would I ever want to stop? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I literally love what I do in a way that most people don't get to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not even going to say most people don't get to. Some people have love in a different way. Because some people, like, the biggest thing in their life that they ever wanted to do was be a mom or be a dad. Or for me, it's be a comic. And I think at the beginning, when I wake up and go to bed every day, that's what I am first. Mm-hmm. I am a dad, you know. But I take humor to everything that I do. Yeah. And I take this kind of comedic view point on every aspect of my life. So it's like I can't even stop being it. So why would I ever desire to stop? But that could show up in a different way. It could show up as comedic acting. It could show up as a game show host.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah. I'm like, I'm just open to the possibility of whatever the future holds to be there, like improv. Yes, and you know what's next.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be denying. Be accepting.
Right.
Thanks, Trey, so much.
Thank you, Adrian. That was awesome.
Okay, we'll dance the night away, but when I see the rain coming. for listening. Download more episodes from the Podbean app. Also available at iTunes and Stitcher or at totallyunrelated.com.